Programming sponsored by Charity Mobile. Life is calling. Take it with you. More information at charitymobile.com.
This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
When I was in high school, I went to an all-boys Catholic high school, a Jesuit high school, where I was focused on academics and athletics, going to church every Sunday at Little Flower. And yes, there were parties. And the drinking age was 18. And yes, the seniors were legal and had beer there. And yes, people might have had too many beers on occasion. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about an allegation of sexual assault. I've never sexually assaulted anyone in high school or for many years thereafter. And the girls from the schools I went to and I were
so
friends.
So you're saying that all through all these years that are in question, you were a virgin?
That's correct.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Good afternoon, friends, and welcome back. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. That clip that you just heard was from last night's Fox News interview with Martha McCallum and the Kavanaughs, Brett and Ashley, responding to allegations of sexual assault, sexual misconduct, allegations that so far are rather unsubstantiated, but there are now at least two people who are going public making at least some form of allegation on this. And it led to that very uncomfortable exchange last night, and kind of exchange that you would not expect necessarily to hear from a Supreme Court justice nominee. I mean, this is delving back farther than probably most of the... this is more or less a case of too much information, things that we didn't really want to know and weren't really asking. Brett Kavanaugh's status as a virgin going out of college is certainly makes for interesting television. I don't know that it really says anything at all about the quality of justice that Brett Kavanaugh would bring to the Supreme Court, which is supposed to be the point of these hearings. Joining me right now is Gail Trotter, an attorney and a spokeswoman for the Judicial Crisis Network, which has been campaigning for Judge Kavanaugh to be confirmed to the Supreme Court. Gail, welcome to the show. Great to talk to you today.
Yes, great to be with you, Ed.
Gail, I got to tell you, I saw this actually after it aired, and I did see, though, that that particular piece of information that we heard at the top of the hour, that was actually reported before the interview aired. I got to tell you, when I saw that, I thought, man, have we really run off the rails here or what?
Right. Well, you remember in the Happy Days series that when Fonzie jumped the shark, that that was the end of that series, and that has kind of gone into common language. When things have become so ridiculous, we say that they have jumped the shark. And we saw that in the sense of the interview last night, that Judge Kavanaugh, after all of these unsubstantiated and discredited allegations, had to do that to defend himself. And I think, Ed, you raised such an important point. The entire history of Supreme Court confirmations and what the Senate is supposed to do in terms of constitutional duties is to give advice and consent to the president. And generally, that has been on whether or not the candidate is qualified to be on the Supreme Court. And clearly, Judge Kavanaugh is. He was given the highest rating by the American Bar Association. Liberal law professors testified and signed statements in favor of his qualifications, and he served on essentially what is seen as the second highest court in the land, the D.C. Circuit, for 12 years, and wrote solid opinions, so much so that over 10 of those opinions, the reasoning in those opinions, were adopted by the Supreme Court when they were deciding the related cases. So it is really the moment that we have jumped the shark in this Supreme Court confirmation process. And I think you can lay it all at the foot of the far left Senate Democrats, who for various reasons decided that before Judge Kavanaugh's name was even released, that they would do everything possible in their power to make sure that his confirmation was derailed.
Yeah, I think you're making a great point. I do need to translate something, though, for potentially younger listeners. If you don't know who Fonzie was, think of it this way. Unfortunately, I know very well who Fonzie was, so I mean, I know exactly what jump the shark means. I actually was watching that episode when it aired and shaking my head in disbelief, Gail. I couldn't believe that they had done that. But but for those of you who don't know what jumping the shark is, if you want to go see Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, just think of it as nuking the fridge. It's the same thing. from that infamous sequel there where he hid in a refrigerator while nuclear testing was going on in the Nevada desert. Yeah, sort of the same thing there, I think. So, Gail Trotter, of course, I agree that this has run off the rails and that the proximate cause of this was the mishandling of Christine Blasey Ford's initial allegation, which was made supposedly anonymously, although it came out later that she had actually met with her congresswoman, who was the one who passed that along to Senator Dianne Feinstein. And it was kept under wraps. It wasn't shared with the Republicans on the committee. It wasn't even shared with the chair, Republican Chuck Grassley, who should have been given access to that information so that it could have been handled privately, at least initially privately, to allow both parties to address the issue in private without it becoming a public spectacle, which is really what this has become. It was never brought up in any of the meetings that Judge Kavanaugh had with Dianne Feinstein, who was the one who was sitting on this information for about 2 months before it leaked out. It didn't come up in the questionnaire. Didn't come up during the public hearing. Didn't come up in a private senators only hearing that was also held apart from the televised hearing. Never came up at all until it was leaked out of the minority side of the committee. At which point, Ms. Ford decided to go to the Washington Post and tell the story on the record. And then, of course, now we have another allegation that just came forward a couple days ago from Deborah Ramirez, who claims that Brett Kavanaugh exposed himself in a particularly vulgar manner during a party at Yale. And again, there are no corroborating witnesses for either of these things. And the people who have been named have said in both cases, I never heard that. It didn't happen in my presence. One of Ford's witnesses, who is apparently a lifelong friend, said, I've never even met Brett Kavanaugh. So these are unsubstantiated allegations. I wouldn't necessarily call them debunked, but they are unsubstantiated. And my question for you, Gail, as a member of the Judicial Crisis Network, and as somebody who is an observer like me of basic American processes and judicial processes, political processes, and those sorts of things, is that there's a burden of proof question that is really what we're facing here, right? I mean, this is the hinge, right? Is that you have on one side people saying, believe the victim, believe the victim. And on the other hand, you have people saying, there's no proof, so therefore you can't act on this. I mean, what is the standard in these cases? What should be the standard in these cases?
Right. I think you're seeing a lot of people in the media and on the left side of the aisle equate the idea that these allegations should be taken seriously to an idea that Judge Kavanaugh is guilty until proven innocent. And that turns our very foundation of American law on its head. And how ironic when this is in the fight for a Supreme Court confirmation where the justices are tasked with upholding our Constitution and ensuring fairness for all Americans, particularly given these allegations. They're very serious. They should be, you know, looked at. And Senator Grassley has bent over backwards to give Dr. Ford every accommodation to make sure that she has the ability to tell her story. But you've seen so much maneuvering back and forth about Judge Kavanaugh should testify first, or, you know, she doesn't want him in the room. Only the older male senator should question Dr. Ford. So it's really trying to make sure that the accusers' requests and demands are all met, instead of thinking about how can this be fair to both parties and how can truth be ascertained. And unfortunately, something going back 35 years without any corroborating witnesses and with lots of holes in the stories. You know, Dr. Ford didn't know the house where it happened or the date that it happened. And you saw the response of Judge Kavanaugh bringing out his calendars from that summer and saying, hey, I wasn't at anything like this. And the contrast of trying to prove what did or didn't happen, it's very weak gruel with Dr. Ford's allegations. Now, the senators are going to have to decide in this situation whether they believe Dr. Ford or Judge Kavanaugh or whether there's enough evidence, but it comes down to facts and evidence. Do they have the evidence and the facts that say that this possibly happened or probably did not happen? And they're going to have to understand that when they undertake this vote. And good for Senator McConnell for saying that this will come to a vote. Judge Kavanaugh said in his interview with Martha McCallum that he is not going away. He's not going to step down. And who could blame him for wanting to vindicate his name and his family's reputation?
Well, indeed. We're speaking with Gail Trotter of the Judicial Crisis Network, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And Gail, I just want to return back to something you said here, because there's a couple other updates on this story, and I want to get to those too. But you said that it's going to come down to whether or not they believe Ms. Ford, or they're going to believe Judge Kavanaugh, but it should come down to the evidence. And I would say this, is that there's a different level of proof when you're dealing with depriving somebody of their liberty through the criminal justice system. If they're charged with a crime, it should be proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and I think everybody understands that it's up to the state to prove that. But I would also say, and I've argued this for about a week now, is that our public life really depends on us allowing people to have the benefit of the doubt until evidence emerges, even in terms of being able to be a public servant or to move up to a different public service role, as Judge Kavanaugh is doing right now, which is that if there are allegations to be made without evidence, there's really no action to take on this. It's unfair to take action against somebody on an allegation that has no corroborating evidence. And as you say, there are gaps in the story. I don't want to say holes, because you can say it either way, but there are at least gaps in the story. There's gaps in the details. There's significant gaps which would prevent even an investigation of taking place. No date, not even the month, no particular place, no time. And the people who are named at this as part of this are saying that they didn't have this didn't happen while they were there. But that to me is, it's a key to whether or not we're going to have fruitful public service. Because in order to have fruitful public service, you're going to have people who are willing to go through the process of being appointed, and in some cases being confirmed at the federal level, being confirmed in these public processes. And if it turns into some place where even just the any allegation, even absent any evidence in support, who are the people who are going to accept those positions in the future?
I could not have said it better than you, and I think that it's important to look back at the history of Supreme Court nominations and see who are the people that this type of character assassination have been leveled at. You look at Judge Robert Bork, who was an esteemed legal mind, maybe one of the brightest of his generation, and you had Ted Kennedy having a litany of offenses that he said that would happen in Judge Bork's America. We saw the same thing happen to Justice Clarence Thomas when he was nominated for the Supreme Court. And we're seeing the same thing again with Judge Kavanaugh. And yet, on the other side of the aisle, when senators opposed Merrick Garland, because the way the Constitution sets up Supreme Court nominations, it's a two-key operation. The president nominates, the Senate decides whether or not to consider the nominee and whether or not to give a vote and to decide up or down on the nominee. There was no character assassination of Merrick Garland. There was no impugning of him. There was not going back and looking at his high school yearbooks to try and make wild allegations against him. There was not this effort to investigate everything, every little detail about his life. Instead, the Senate said, we're going to give the American people the chance in this presidential election to decide if they want Donald Trump picking the next Supreme Court nominee or Hillary Clinton picking the next Supreme Court nominee. And President Trump made that a signature issue of his campaign. And one out of five voters said that they were going to, that the primary reason they decided to vote in the 2016 presidential election was because they cared about Supreme Court vacancies. And of those voters, 58% voted for Donald Trump. So I think you raise an excellent point, Ed, and it seems to be it only affects one side of the aisle. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, do you know who voted for her? Strom Thurmond couldn't be more opposed to her judicial philosophy, but he voted to confirm Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It seems like the character assassination only goes one way.
All right, so Gail Trotter, Judicial Crisis Network. I just want to bring listeners up to speed on a couple of different developments here. We thought that there was going to be a hearing on Thursday, and apparently now there's some question as to whether or not Dr. Ford is going to show up for this hearing. Dianne Feinstein just commented, and I just saw this coming across my wire, saying that that she has no way of knowing if she's actually going to show up because Republicans decided to hire an outside counsel to ask questions of the witness. And this is this was a condition that was pretty well discussed by Senator Grassley during the negotiations. He held firm that they were going to bring in an outside counsel to handle the questioning. So that it would be somebody with some expertise in the subject matter. And let's face it, they wanted to find a woman who would be able to handle this sensitively. And they objected at the time. They agreed to show up, still objecting. And now apparently there was a letter from her attorneys last night saying that they're still objecting to this. They want to know. They want to basically interview this person, and they want her resume, and they are not happy about this. So if she doesn't show up, if she decides not to show up, Chuck Grassley has said in the past, if she doesn't show up, we're going to just go right to a markup session, which is basically where they. Where the committee votes on whether to pass the nomination onto the Senate. Do you still see that as what will wind up happening, or are we looking at more negotiations?
Well, given the track record, there have been so many bending over backwards accommodations for Dr. Ford to be able to tell her story. I think it would be reasonable to conclude that there might be more accommodations, more negotiations. But anybody watching this process from the outside would say, no, you should proceed to a vote. You have done everything possible within the principles of fairness and justice to afford her the opportunity to tell her story to the Senate before they make their decision to confirm Judge Kavanaugh. And I think that given the outrageousness of the Senate Democrats' behavior to delay, that this vote should be proceeded to expeditiously. And we've seen weeks go by. And like you said, Dianne Feinstein could have brought this up, you know, 2 months ago, and she chose not to. So I think at a certain point, the Senate has got to decide not to continue stringing Judge Kavanaugh along, but to have, you know, all the hearings were concluded. Dr. Ford has been given many, many opportunities to give her testimony in many different forms. And if she chooses not to show up at this last minute, in some ways it seems like I'm not saying her, but her team, maybe for political reasons or, you know, being kind of used by the Senate Democrats to get to the result they want, which is to continue to delay this vote until after the midterm elections, then the Senate Republicans should go ahead and take the vote. And the hope is that the Republican caucus will hang together to support Judge Kavanaugh, as well they should. And the three Democrats from Trump-supporting states, West Virginia, Montana, North Dakota, and Indiana, could also vote for Judge Kavanaugh, too. And then he would have some bipartisan support. And that is the result we hope to see as soon as possible. But given the drama of this entire process, it's hard to say with any certainty what is going to happen.
Speaking with Gail Trotter of the Judicial Crisis Network, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Let's talk to Roslyn in Vista, California, who wants to join the conversation. Roslyn, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much. I just want to throw in my two cents This is just like in the 1800s when they had a lynch mob and a hanging, or the Ku Klux Klan. You know, they didn't need evidence either. They just made up their own mind. And this is what it just is like. She's had too many chances. And you know what I think? I think it's all fake ruse just to stall for time.
Rosalind, thank you very much for your call. I'm going to throw this. I get what Rosalind is saying. I'm going to use a couple of different examples, though. I would say that this reminds me a lot, Gail, and I'm not sure how well you remember this, but it reminds me a lot of the panic that was going on around the McMartin preschool allegations.
Yeah.
And the hyper hysteria about satanic child abuse that turned out to be basically nothing. Not that child abuse doesn't occur, but just whipping people up is what ended up putting these people on trial for what turned out to be nothing at all. And at least one of them was in prison for 5 years before they finally reversed it and got him out of there. I mean, this is the type. That's the reason why I would say, Gail, that burden of proof traditions are so important in American society, and not just when you're talking about criminal trials. I'm talking about people who are being tried in the court of public opinion as well.
That's right, and this is not just about being on the Supreme Court or about a job, which in itself is a huge deprival of anybody, deprivation, but for Judge Kavanaugh and his family, they have really been dragged through the mud. And he has a right to show, you know, try to clear his name and get his story and his point of view out there. And I'm sure it came as a shock to him, even though we've seen this tactic before, that this has been used in such a brutal, brutal fashion. And when you think about the videos coming out from Hollywood stars and definitely the press, chiming in as well on top of the far left Democratic senators, it does seem like those folks are continuing their orchestrated effort to try and derail this nomination. And while, like you said, there are certainly constant sexual abuse that we see in society all the time and that should be vigorously prosecuted with appropriate punishment for the people who are doing these things, you cannot have guilt by association. You cannot say there's a problem in society and then convict all men of, you know, criminal behavior. You have to look at the facts and evidence. You have to have a fair hearing, a fair opportunity to be heard. And Judge Kavanaugh, up until this point, it has really been maligned in this process in quite an unfair way. And I sincerely hope that the Senate Democrats who have, you know, decided to conduct themselves this way will be ashamed of themselves and will walk it back, because otherwise they're putting politics in a fever pitch just to accomplish their aims.
Let's try to get one more call in really quickly. Joe in California, welcome to the show. I got about 20 seconds to make your point.
Okay, I was wondering why Feinstein held on to this letter from Ford since June.
Since late July. That's a good question, Joe, and thank you very much for your... Gail, I'll let you answer that quickly. We've got about a minute left.
I think her rationale was that she had been asked to keep the identity of Dr. Ford confidential, and she didn't want to violate that confidentiality, but that doesn't really add up after the fact, because Dr. Ford had shared information with the Washington Post before she shared the information with Dr. Feinstein. She also shared the information with her local U.S. representative as well. So when you look at the timeline of events, it doesn't add up, and the rationale given to protect the confidentiality doesn't make much sense either.
It doesn't, and it still doesn't negate the fact that that type of detrimental information is something that should have been shared with other members of the committee, especially if nobody else, with the chair of the committee, Chuck Grassley, who has got a pretty good record of protecting whistleblowers that come forward. And if the point of that process was to make sure that you don't put somebody who is unworthy on the Supreme Court, then that is the proper way to do it. Gail Trotter, Judicial Crisis Network, thank you for being with us today. You can find out more about the Judicial Crisis Network at judicialnetwork.com, judicialnetwork.com. I'm Ed Morrissey of hotair.com, filling in for Drew Mariani, and we'll be right back.
Hello, Father James Kubicki here. And as a Jesuit priest, I take a vow of poverty, and so I'm not too familiar with diamonds and other precious jewels. But I've heard that the job of a diamond appraiser is very difficult. Imagine having to look at trays and trays of diamonds all day and determining their value when they all sort of look alike. One appraiser was asked how he could look at all those diamonds and not get confused. How could he maintain a fixed standard on which to judge all those diamonds? He responded by holding out his hand and pointing to a beautiful diamond ring on his finger. He said, "This diamond is perfect. It doesn't have a single flaw. Every half hour or so, I look at it very carefully, and the mental picture of it helps me maintain the standards." I think there's a great application here to our lives. You could say that Jesus is our perfect diamond because he reveals to us what it means to be fully human. He's the standard by which you need to judge yourself, your thoughts, your words, your choices, and actions. But just like the diamond appraiser, it's easy to forget the standard unless you periodically look at the perfect diamond in order to keep an image of it in your mind. You need to look daily and perhaps periodically throughout the day at Jesus. That's what prayer is all about, reading the Gospels or calling them to mind in order to keep Jesus before you, his thoughts and feelings, his values and standards. If you do that and add faithful reception of the sacraments, you'll become a perfect diamond yourself.
Listen to more of Father James Kubicki's daily reflections by downloading the free Relevant Radio app.
Have a question about the Bible or the faith? Give Father Simon a call.
You know, one God, one Christ, one church, as far as I can figure out.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite sure where Catholicism fits in that picture.
By the end of the first century, there were all these little groups of people who had come under the name of Christian or followers of Jesus. So they decided they would talk about the Church of the Bishops, those believers who thought Jesus had established an organization which had Jewish structures. Bishops were from a different Jewish sect, elders and deacons, these were all Jewish concepts, and they believed Jesus had established his authority. It was called the Church of the Bishops. But about 90 AD, this movement was growing so fast, and it spread through the Roman Empire and spread east into the Persian Empire, so they began to call it the Universal Church, to contrast it with these little philosophical sects. And the word universal in Greek means Catholic.
Father Simon Says, 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific, on Relevant Radio.
The timing couldn't be better. The biggest, most revealing, and important film about abortion ideology and horrible consequences is about to premiere, just as the Supreme Court confirmation vote on Judge Kavanaugh is about to take place. Big abortion activists are trying everything to stop both. I'm Shiva Logminas. Filmmaker Phelan McAleer gives you a closer look at what to do to help get out the truth. 6 Eastern, 3 Pacific, here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
We have this great trust as a child. The world kind of takes that from us, and we start to feel that we're holier than thou. And that's not it at all. We're just being who we are as Catholics.
Talk radio for Catholic life to start your day.
Morning Air on Relevant Radio.
The Relevant Radio studio line is sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters. Information about employment opportunities and their flexible premium life insurance plans available at relevantradio.com/Forrester.
You've watched the fight. You've watched the tactics. But here's what I want to tell you. In the very near future, Judge Kavanaugh will be on the United States Supreme Court.
All the issues, all the topics, one place.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 34 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. As we talk a little bit about the Brett Kavanaugh hearings and the Brett Kavanaugh issues, it seems like in part this is almost like a nostalgia thing. There was a big spread in the New York Times yesterday, or this morning, I should say, regarding Brett Kavanaugh's high school yearbooks and what the entries there might have meant. what it was like being at an Ivy League college in the early 1980s. Joining us now is Dr. Paul Kenger, a professor of political science at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. He's also the executive director for the Center of Vision and Values. His latest book is A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. He's actually at a conference this week in Washington, D.C. on that very topic. And Dr. Paul Kenger, I want to talk a little bit about that. I want to get to a better topic, which is about Ronald Reagan's soul craft eventually in this half hour. But I think that perhaps an idea of what that childhood was like, or teenage years, adolescence was like in the late 1970s, early 1980s, might be that we might need a refresher course on that, Paul. I mean, what when you see all these stories about Brett Kavanaugh and his yearbook and the whatever it was that he called himself, King of the Keg Party or something like that. I mean, I flash back to my adolescence, and I think, man, if everybody believed everything I said about myself back then, nobody'd let me near anything.
Yes, well, it's certainly true for me, Ed. I'll tell you, I was really pretty rotten. At that point in my life, it took a few years to climb out of the pit. I was an ex-Catholic and agnostic, if not borderline atheist. I think Kavanaugh and I were born about the same year. I was born in 1966, and I went to a lot of parties where people behaved just like that. And you know that now that said, it's interesting that in his interview with he and his wife did with Martha McCallum on Fox, he said that he was a virgin all the way up through high school and into college, which is a pretty remarkable thing to share with the public, right? And but it's kind of, in fact, frankly, I think it really makes it more believable, because most people wouldn't believe that anybody who came out of that background or out of that era, there weren't very many virgins at that point. It's not the kind of thing that you'd think you would make up. You'd think it's probably true. But a lot of it just seems so, look, he's innocent until he's proven guilty. And I know people listening are probably saying, well, yeah, but these are he said, she said situations. That's not fair to the girl. And I know, I agree, it's not. Look, I have three daughters. I have boys too. I also have boys. But actually, in the situation with Christine Ford, it's not really he said, she said. It's she said, he said, he said, because she claims that there was another boy in the room as well, and he can't corroborate the story. So unfortunately, and this is the sad reality of the way the situations are. But if she can't prove that these claims, or even that they were at that party together, or that the other person in the room saw what she said the other person in the room saw, then you can't persecute, or I would say even vote against Kat. You have to presume guilt, or presume innocence, unless you can prove guilt.
Well, I would say that I'm not even sure you need to necessarily prove it. I think the issue here is that there just isn't any evidence, absent the allegation itself, that this ever took place. And right. I think in the absence of any sort of evidence and detailed evidence about when and where this took place, so that the accused has a proper opportunity to respond to it after 36 years, that to me is where I land on this, is that it's a process issue. And I don't think that you have to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in order to be disqualified to serve as a Supreme Court justice, or to serve as a cabinet member, or to serve in the United States Senate, for that matter. But I do think right. that if there's an allegation, that there should be some substantiation for it before it becomes an issue of belief. And I think that that's the part that I'm having difficulty with in saying, well, you have to believe the woman. I think you have to take the woman seriously. I think you should take Dr. Ford seriously. Yeah. I think you should look at the allegation seriously. And I think we all have to acknowledge that these things do happen. They happen at parties. Right. They happen with teenagers. They're not good things to happen. They are very bad things to happen. And a lot of times women don't report it, especially teenage girls, probably. Right. Out of fear of having to say, hey, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I was doing bad things like drinking or whatever it was.
Absolutely.
You have to allow for that, right?
Yeah, you do. And also, too, I mean, what he's being accused of would have been at the age of 17.
Right.
We know of no improper behavior at all of him in his 50s, 40s, 30s. I guess even in his 20s, depending on when this alleged Yale allegation might have taken place.
Right.
And, you know, as opposed to, say, a Bill Clinton, or, you know, I'll be bipartisan about this, Donald Trump, right?
Right.
Accusations against Trump as an adult. And even the other Supreme Court case with Clarence Thomas, what Thomas was alleged to have done would have been after law school, when he was a working professional with Anita Hill. And in that case, in the case of Clarence Thomas, that didn't involve him physically touching Anita Hill or anything like that. That was about alleged crude comments, right?
Yes, and taking place in a federal office. And taking place in a federal office, which, you know, certainly is, absolutely. And so I think that one of the issues that I struggle with, and it's the reason why I was glad that you talked about this, is the fact that we're talking about stuff that happened, like I said, this New York Times article from earlier today about things that were written in a yearbook when you're 17 years old. There are things written in my yearbook, in my yearbooks, that I probably wouldn't want people to know about. I mean, they're not awful, but...
Mine's gone, Ed. I'll tell you, I will make a confession here on National Catholic Radio. when I met the woman who's now my wife, and we started dating and we were engaged, and I went home and I saw that yearbook in my drawer, I threw that sucker in the trash. It is gone. There's nothing in there that could incriminate me. I wanted that thing as far away from my future spouse as it could possibly be. And I didn't do, you know, God is my witness, I never did anything like what Christine Ford is accusing Brett Kavanaugh of, but I didn't exactly live a morally exemplar life either. So, the stuff we did when we were 15, 16, 17 years old in the early 80s, very few of us can be proud of that record, I'm sure.
I'm right there with you. Mine was about 3 years ahead of you, but I was 1963 is when I was born. So for me, it was more like the late 70s and into the early 80s. But yes, I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
Even worse, right. Even where you have the 70s, except for the music. The music was better in the 70s. But
yeah.
I digress. But in terms of your old yearbooks, folks, I think Dr. Paul Kanger and I can agree that the best advice comes from the movie Aliens. Nuke it from space. It's the only way to be sure.
That's right.
So, let's take a quick break. We're talking with Dr. Paul Kanger. And when we come back from our break, I want to talk about a very interesting topic, which is Ronald Reagan's soulcraft. This is an article that Dr. Paul Kanger wrote for the American Spectator. And it came out earlier this week, late last week. And it is really an amazing piece, an amazing reflection on the spiritual side of Ronald Reagan, a side that we didn't necessarily see in great depth when he was president. But this is a really great window into this. We're talking with Dr. Paul Kanger. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Your life connected.
Your faith is at your fingertips. The Relevant Radio app.
Now it's got Apple CarPlay in addition to Android Auto. So the actual Relevant Radio app, if you got a smart car with one of those screens now, actually shows up on your dashboard.
The Relevant Radio app.
If you want to listen to anything you heard today, you wanted to pray the chaplet or whatever it may be. It's such a great app. It has prayers. Just a great way to listen to the show and revisit anything you missed.
The Relevant Radio app for your smart device. It's in your app store.
Hi, this is Drew Mariani, and you know prayer is powerful. And prayer to God through the Blessed Mother is even more powerful. Let's pray right now for an end to abortion in our country. Let's pray 100 million memoraries this year for an end to abortion and the protection of human life from the moment of conception through natural death. Hey, we pray one memorare an hour, we'll reach our goal by the end of the year. Join me now. Remember, O most gracious Virgin Mary, that never was it known that anyone who fled to your protection, implored your help, or sought your intercession was ever left unaided. Inspired by this confidence, I fly unto you, O Virgin of virgins, my mother. To you I come, before you I stand, sinful and sorrowful. O Mother of the Word incarnate, despise not my petitions, but in your mercy hear and answer me. Amen.
Add your memoraries to the tally at relevantradio.com/mom.
Would you like to help Catholic school families and Relevant Radio at the same time?
Sign up to be a Relevant Radio school ambassador.
Catholic Radio is an amazing educational tool that can help us, as parents and grandparents, teach the faith to our children.
Yet not all Catholics know that it exists.
If you are a parent or grandparent of a child in Catholic school or a student at a Catholic high school or college, go to relevantradio.com or email volunteers at relevantradio.com to sign up to be a school ambassador today.
Did the people you work with know you're Catholic? Anybody ever ask you a question about your faith? Tomorrow on Morning Air, Brother Greg Cellini joins us to talk about how you can bring faith into the workplace without being overbearing, and also how to talk about our faith when we're challenged in the workplace. Also tomorrow, hear the miracle of the Hope Monstrance, live to Rome for the Pope's General Weekly Audience, and Father Albert Haas with spiritual direction on Morning Air at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 Pacific, tomorrow on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Relevant Radio accepts donations of unwanted vehicles. The process is easy, free, and it helps keep Relevant Radio rolling. More information at 888-906-9069 or relevantradio.com.
Your life, your country, connected.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 46 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Speaking right now with Dr. Paul Kanger, professor of political science at Grove City College in Pennsylvania, also the executive director for the Center for Vision and Values, and his latest book is A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. And you're right in the swamp, Paul. Right? You're in Washington D.C. talking about this topic.
Yeah, I'm actually on my way there. I'm on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and I got to tell you, it is raining like crazy. So, but I will be. This is a conference on John Paul II and Ronald Reagan, and arranged by the White House Writers Group, Clark Judge, Peter Robinson, Josh Gilder, who were all Reagan speech writers. It's an amazing conference. You probably Google it and find out about it online. And the kickoff dinner is tonight, and the actual conference is tomorrow.
That's amazing. It should be an amazing, amazing event. And of course, you're probably going to be the star there because, again, you've just been writing about this. You've got the book out for this, and that's the reason why. When I saw the article from Karen Tumulty in the Washington Post a few days ago, last week actually, about Ronald Reagan's letter to his father-in-law, as his father-in-law was getting ready to pass into the next life, it really struck me how much we didn't get a chance to see that side of Ronald Reagan. Not necessarily because it wasn't apparent, but maybe just because we weren't paying a whole lot of attention to that at the time with the Cold War and everything else that was going on. But this is a man who thought deeply about spiritual matters. Now, I know you weren't surprised because, of course, you've been researching this for a very long time. But, I was struck by the depth and the passion that Reagan brought into this letter trying to save the soul of his father-in-law. How much love there was for his father-in-law as his father-in-law was getting ready to pass into the next life. And just the whole thing struck me as a sort of a sign of Reagan that I don't know that we really, broadly, we didn't recognize at the time.
Well, that's right. And on so many different fronts, Ed, Karen Tumulty pointed out that, why would the President of the United States, and she said in a positive, admiring way, just take so much time out of his day, August 7th, 1982, to sit down and write a 4-page handwritten letter to his father-in-law. And actually, I could tell you, Reagan spent many days writing letters like that throughout his presidency. And my first research trip to the Reagan Library, it would have been the summer of 2001. And that ended up going into my first book on Reagan, which was on the faith of Reagan, God and Ronald Reagan. And I started reading through those letters. I was just blown away by them, the sheer volume of them, how long they were, how they were written to everybody from heads of state to John Paul II, Margaret Thatcher, Leonid Brezhnev, all the way to people you never heard of before, like Ruth Smith of Coeur d'Alene, Iowa, and others. But Reagan, in fact, Ed, we now estimate that Reagan may have wrote more letters as president than any president since Thomas Jefferson. There's actually that many. And I resolved the next summer that I went to the Reagan Library that I would read through all of these letters because they were so powerful. You learn so much about the guy by reading the letters. And yet the next summer when I went there, I started reading. I think I got about halfway through 1982, and that was it. There were just so many of them. But this one where he reaches out to his dying father-in-law, who's a non-believer, and Reagan cares about his soul, and Reagan basically employs a line of reasoning or argumentation that listeners here would recognize as C.S. Lewis's liar, lord, or lunatic argument. He makes that argument in that letter to Loyal Davis, August 1982. But I had seen Reagan use that exact argument in other letters, previous letters to other people, including a letter that I found where Reagan was writing to a Methodist minister in 1978, using Lewis's liar, lord, or lunatic argument. So you see there, yes, his care for individual souls, the fact that he would devote time like that to something like this, and the fact that he would use, you know, pretty sophisticated theological arguments to try to persuade a person on his deathbed to accept Christ, to believe in Christ.
Yeah, I mean, this is a man who was engaged enough to use apologetics, to use fairly sophisticated apologetic arguments. He's somebody. This is the thing that gets me about how people perceived Reagan at the time. You know, because this was the first president I ever voted for, was Ronald Reagan, and he was portrayed as sort of the amiable dunce, and that was actually the nice portrayal of Ronald Reagan by some of his critics. But this is
right.
This is a man who was very intellectual. He was very well read. He was very, very well written. And he thought of these things in depth, and they touched his heart. And I think, you know, you talked about Karen Tumulty saying this in a praiseworthy way, right, at the Washington Post. And I was struck by that tone, too. It was very respectful. It was admiring.
Yeah.
The tone was in the Washington Post. And I was very impressed by that because it's difficult not to admire this kind of passion, this kind of care for one's father-in-law, but also this level of intellectual depth.
Right, right. Well, and also, too, I mean, there's probably a lot of people who are thinking, well, okay, this is a nice thing to do, but man, it's the middle of the Cold War. Leonid Brezhnev is approaching death at that point. Reagan's tax policies are being enacted. You've got all these problems in the economy, unemployment, trade, Middle East, Beirut, Lebanon, all of that going on. It almost seems like a kind of a waste of time to just sit down and spend an hour like this writing this perfectly composed letter, no smudges on it. You know, maybe he actually must have rewritten it a few times because nothing is crossed out, nothing's deleted in it. But Ronald Reagan, Ed, and I have many statements from him on this. Reagan argued that, look, there's nothing more important than the individual soul.
Right.
Countries, empires, of course they're important, but they're not eternal. They come and go, whereas individuals have souls, which makes them eternal. So at stake here was whether or not this man who Reagan cared about, he liked, he admired, he respected his father-in-law, and also other people who Reagan, you know, didn't know at all, didn't know from Adam, right, that he wrote to, and he made this same sort of argument. He cared about their souls because they could spend eternity separated from God. And, you know, again, empires come and go, but there's nothing more important than the soul. So to Reagan, if you would have asked him, gee, Mr. President, is this really worth your time? He would have said, yes, this is absolutely worth my time. In a way, there's nothing more important than devoting my time to precisely this.
Exactly. This is the highest calling that we as Christians would have. We're speaking with Dr. Paul Kenger, and we're taking your calls at 888 888- 914-914-9149. Let's go to the phones. Brian in Chicago wants to join the conversation with a question. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is for Dr. Kangor. Doctor, I read your book, God and Ronald Reagan. It's very good. I read it several years ago, though, and I have a question. I don't know if I read it there or somewhere else, but I read that that Ronald Reagan, in fact, I think from your book that he went to church prior to his presidency and after his presidency, but he did not go during. And I read somewhere that he didn't go during his presidency because of, I think it was like, quote-unquote, security reasons. And when I think about that, I'm wondering, what does security reasons mean? Does it mean that he was afraid that if somebody tried to assassinate him, that they would shoot someone else by mistake? Or did he not want to put security detail, have them go through the hassle of going with them to church every week? What is it meant by security reasons, if I'm correct?
Yeah, no, you got it exactly right. You remember all this very well. And I'll start by saying this. Reagan attended church on a regular basis throughout his life, prior to his presidency, and then immediately at the end of his presidency, joined a church again in Hollywood, and even insisted on taking the new members class with his wife. And when he got to Washington, D.C., he immediately joined the National Presbyterian Church. He had been part of the Bel Air Presbyterian Church of the Reverend Don Neumann in Hollywood, in Los Angeles, prior to the presidency. I even talked to his pastor of the National Presbyterian Church, the Reverend Louis Evans, who passed away a few years ago, and John Boyles, the associate pastor, who's still alive today. So Reagan actually attended church services each of those Sundays prior to the assassination attempt. The assassination attempt was March 30th, 1981. He attended, we think, at least four or five out of the first five or six Sundays that he was president. What changed it was indeed that assassination attempt. And it became, among other things, not just a hassle for him, but everybody at the church,
right,
when they would go to services on Sunday, they had to pass through metal detectors. There were literally SWAT men on the buildings across the street and on top of the church. Everybody had to be frisked before they went in. Then they got inside, and of course everybody would stare at Reagan, and he felt that he was a distraction to the congregation as well. And then even after all of that, Reagan felt that they couldn't fully guarantee the safety of the congregation. Remember this event, October 6, 1981, that was when Anwar Sadat was assassinated. And he was assassinated by a volley of gunfire at a military parade in Cairo in Egypt. Reagan was afraid that somebody, a terrorist, might try to drive a truck with explosives right into the front of the church, like what happened with the attack in Beirut, Lebanon in October 1983 with our Marines. 241 of our Marines were killed. So Reagan got to the point where he said, I really hate this. This is sad. This is really sick. But I'm just going to have to stop going to church services on a regular basis while I'm president. And an important point is, that made a lot of people think, oh, well, Reagan's not really a real Christian then. I mean, gee, the guy doesn't even go to church. But Reagan felt that for security reasons, that's what he had to do. And he really hated it. He really missed attending church.
And Dr. Paul Kangor, I mean, those security issues have really been part of every president's choices after that as well. I mean, without getting into what you think, or, you know, because we shouldn't judge what people's religious commitments are, but it's a huge security issue. And I'd argue even more so after 9/11, that it's, while you're president, it's kind of difficult to go to church every week. We've got about 10 seconds left. I'll just give you a real quick response to that.
Right, and for Reagan, in his case, people say, well, the next president went more frequently to church, but at that point, terrorism was really new in America,
right,
as well.
That's exactly so. Right. Dr. Paul Kangor has been our guest. He's the professor of political science at Grove City College in Pennsylvania, the author of A Pope, A President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and The Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com. We'll be right back.